Joining us on the line now is Debbie Gendler. She's a four-time Emmy-nominated talent and development executive and producer, formerly at CBS and ABC. She was one of a handful of lucky fans who were in the live audience for the Beatles' historic performance on The Ed Sullivan Show, an iconic television event viewed in the living rooms of 73 million Americans. Everyone has a story to share about where they were when they watched the appearance, but very few were there in person, and even fewer would go on to not just meet the Beatles but end up building an entire career around the band. But Debbie did just that. Her new book, I Saw Them Standing There, shares her adventures. Welcome to the show, Debbie.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Oh, it's lovely to have you. Thank you for joining us. So prior to the Beatles actually arriving in America, you'd actually met with their manager, Brian Epstein, about starting a U.S. fan club.
Yes, I did. I received an early copy of Please Please Me, in America, that is, early, when family friends visited the UK and brought me back the album as a gift. And I spent pretty much the early months of 1963 desperately trying to find friends who would love the Beatles as much as I did, and to no avail. I couldn't find anyone or get anyone interested. So I wrote a letter to their a UK fan club. I still remember the address, 13 Monmouth Street in London. And I waited to hear, and I never received any response at all. And this was from late April, early May 1963, until I came home from school right around Halloween, last days of October. And my mom was standing there, and she was holding a yellow piece of paper, a Western Union telegram from a lawyer in New York City, who was asking me to please attend a meeting to discuss organizing fans for the Beatles' eventual arrival in America.
How amazing. They were asking you to come to a meeting, and you were still at school.
I was really at school. I was only 13 years old. Now, they didn't know that from the letter I had written. And my dad drove me into New York, and it was really unbelievable that I had no school that day, because it was a holiday in the States called Veterans Day. And so he drove me in. We lived in New Jersey, about 26 miles from Manhattan. And he drove me across the George Washington Bridge. And I went to the meeting, and we walked into the lawyer's office on West 55th Street. And he looked up at me, saw I was like 13, and then there were like three gentlemen in an adjacent room who I was then walked in to meet, and one of them was Brian. And of course, they saw a 13-year-old, but it worked out great, because having gone in to meet them and shown my devotion and interest, and my never-ending devotion, actually, they sent me a ticket to be in the live studio audience at the Ed Sullivan Show.
Oh, amazing. Incredible. What a great story. So you were you at the beginning then, starting up the U.S. fan club for the Beatles?
Well, actually, not really. You know, I mean, they needed professional people as a 13-year-old. I didn't have the skills to do that. But what I did do is, after they hired a staff and the lawyer, Walter Hoffer, moved from that original office on 55th Street, he moved to West 57th Street because he formed with Brian an entity called Beatles USA Limited. And the actual fan club was run out of Mr. Hoffer's law office. And, more adult-like people were hired to participate in the club. But because they knew me, I started a chapter in New Jersey, but it was different than the other chapters because I had met Mr. Hoffer. I had met the women who were running the club. And so I was used and asked to go on local New York tri-state TV, give print interviews when they needed a fan. So I was a little bit more active, and I led crazy adventures for fans for years, like staging a sleep-in in front of the Astor Theater on Broadway, right in Times Square on Broadway and 45th Street. The theater doesn't stand anymore. A hotel, the Marriott Marquis, took its place, but in front of the theater for the pre-sale of tickets for the premiere of A Hard Day's Night in the summer of 1964, and other things like that where I was asked to get fans together.
Amazing. So tell us about that historic moment then, going to see them on the Ed Sullivan Show. I mean, did you hear much of the music with all the screaming, or were you screaming yourself?
Well, you know, I went there with all the good intentions to be adult-like. I mean, my mom even gave me a necklace of hers to wear because I spent like hours trying to figure out what I was going to wear, even going to the show. And I sat there and I thought, oh, I'm going to really be calm. That was impossible because from the very first note when All My Loving started, I looked to my right and behind me and everyone was screaming. And guess what? So was I. And I was like looking around and there was sheer just love, love, and more love coming from the audience. I was up in the mezzanine, and at first I was quite upset that I got stuck in the mezzanine, but then realized, you know, a seat is better than no seat, and how lucky I was to be there. So during the show, though, I remember thinking, wow, each of the Beatles are actually looking up at all the fans in the mezzanine. And, you know, isn't that wonderful that they really considered us high up and not just the supposedly fancier, more important people seated in the audience? But I must tell you, it was magical. I did hear them, where so many people think, no, we couldn't hear. It wasn't like any of the stadium venues that began to happen later on I was at Shea Stadium. I did not hear a single thing. My remembrances of that is only, you know, John Lennon playing the keyboard with his elbow back and forth. I mean, I didn't hear anything. But in the TV studio, even with the screaming, the amplification and the sound system, because it was so small, we could still hear, but it was electric. I couldn't breathe. It was just an amazing moment.
Yeah. And it's obviously amazing to look back on, you know, when you look at the TV footage. Can you see yourself in the TV footage? Probably not if you're in the mezzanine.
Yeah. They took audience pan shots here and there. And sometimes I think I see myself. Some people spot me and call me up and say, hey, I think I saw you. But, you know, I don't know. However, one thing, there was a group of four girls sitting behind me, and one of them saw me in an interview and contacted me, and she said, we talked and we remembered what our conversation was. So she remembers me.
Oh, and lovely.
Yeah. So we're in touch now. She lives in Wilmington, Delaware. I live in Los Angeles. But it's nice that some of us have been able to find each other who were in the audience, and we've sort of formed a little collective that we call each other Beatles sisters.
So. Oh, lovely. That's so nice. So you were there at the start of the Beatles 1965 summer tour of America. You were the only teen to welcome them, I understand. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, because I had the ability to hang around the law office, also the fan club, I heard early on that the I was told that the show promoter, which in this case was Sid Bernstein, in every city would be able to select someone from the fan club to greet the Beatles officially. And because this was the start of that summer 1965 tour, he was going to be finding someone not just to be at the press conference, but to also welcome them to America. I went to the fan club organizers, who knew of all of my volunteer hard work in organizing people. And I said, please select me. And they said, well, it's up to Sid Bernstein. And I had met him on a couple of occasions. And I just hoped that he would know my name, remember me. And sure enough, my wish was granted. And I was selected. And it was a Friday, August 13th, 1965. I was now 15 years old. And I went to the Warwick Hotel in New York City, fought my way through and got there, waited, saw the Beatles arrive running out of their limousine around a revolving door in the entranceway, down a few steps to the elevator bank, up to their suite on the 33rd floor. And probably 20 minutes after their arrival, everyone was ushered into a conference room. It was called the Warwick Room. And I was seated there amongst probably 200 of the New York City press and media there. And then all of a sudden, as I was seated, in came the Beatles. It was like, wow. I was close at the Ed Sullivan Show, but here I was like 10 feet away. And I tell a very detailed story about my meeting because it was a little bit, you know, bittersweet. It was very, very sweet to be there. But when I was brought up to the Beatles room, a suite to actually be introduced to each one of them, it was a little awkward. So, and maybe a little too long to get into, but it was an amazing opportunity and something that really in those years from 64 through 65 really set a path where, you know, I had been exposed to media and television and reporters and radio and things. And I decided that I wanted, you know, a career. Like so many other people, I was just one of the millions who saw the Ed Sullivan Show, me fortunately, right there, but still, you know, for people at home watching on their television sets. And it was a pivotal moment in so many people's lives that as I go around and speak about the book, I mean, everyone has their own Beatles adventures to share. So it's a beautiful, beautiful thing, and why I decided to write the book in the first place, because it gave so, it gives so many of us original fans an opportunity to relive, to talk about the happiest, happiest moments in our lives when we were young and hopeful and energetic. It was a beautiful time.
Oh, yeah, lovely. I'm dying to know, though, why meeting them was so awkward. can you summarize?
Well, I will try my best in the time we have. What happened is that after the Beatles were let out in the media, immediately disappeared, I was alone with all the things that they had touched on the table. There were Ringo's cigarette package that he twisted in his hands, the ashtray that contained the cigarette butts and the ashes, a napkin that George Harrison had used and wiped his mouth, and a glass still with some water that Paul McCartney had taken, had drunk from. And I sat there and I thought, oh, wouldn't these be perfect for my memorabilia collection? Oh, yes. And, you know, the goodness in me that you don't take things was at odds with that need of that Beatle diehard fan who said this is future memorabilia that no one else had. And so I thought, okay, no one's here. I looked around and I took Ringo's cigarette pack. I threw into my bag, which was a shoulder bag, and opened up, throw in the ashtray with the ashes, the napkin. I suddenly heard someone coming from me, and I thought, oh, there was the glass, Paul McCartney's glass that he drank from with some water. Oh, I'll just throw it in there, just for safekeeping. So I threw it in. I got led upstairs. There was a great commotion going on. When I got out of the freight elevator onto the entranceway into the hotel suite, because there was a girl who had climbed up 33 floors on the hotel fire escape, begging to come in at the other side of the window. At that point, George Harrison took a peek around the side. The girl was being pulled in through the window. They opened the window, and hotel security and New York City police officers pulling her through and pushing her through to the hallway towards the freight elevator that I had just come out of. And I was standing in the side, and I could hear George tell the security, "Let her stay. Let her stay." And they said, no, other people could come up and come into it, the room. So they didn't want anyone to go downstairs and be able to say that that was easy access to the Beatles. And so I was then finally let in. George was there and sort of gave me a wave like we actually knew each other. I mean, I had only seen him about 90 seconds earlier, but hey, that was fine. And then there was Paul, who even in those days to me, I thought, wow, does he look happy to be in New York City? And then came John. And this was what the bittersweet aspect was, is that here I was with my heroes who I had, oh my goodness, right, spent since late April, May 1963, and fought my friends in seventh grade to love the Beatles as much as I did. And here they were standing right before me. And John points to my bag and he says, "What's that?" And the corner of the seam of the bag was dripping onto the hotel carpeting, a puddle of darkened water laced with the ash from the ashtray and water from Paul McCartney's glass of water dripping onto the hotel suite carpeting. He said, "What is that?" He goes, "Let me look at the bag."
Oh, no.
Approached him. I stood there. I opened the bag. And he goes to me. He looks down. He goes, "It's rubbish." You know, however, like a scouser would say, rubbish, 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 right? It's rubbish. I said to him, "It isn't. It's precious. It's for my memorabilia collection." You know, what would a 15-year-old say to John Lennon saying what I had collected was rubbish? And I stood there. Ringo sort of glided away. It was like, hey, I don't want to get involved in this mess. And I stood there and he was sort of, I don't want to say berating me, but like really questioning me. Like he said, "You're rubbish, girl. You're a rubbish girl." And I said, "It's not rubbish." I said, it's precious. And Fortunately, I didn't know what to do. I was just there before John Lennon, and I was saved by a sandwich. Because all of a sudden, a tray of these New York style, and I think, you know, you, all your listeners understand, New York had these like immense sandwiches from like the Stage Deli, where this came from, of turkey or roast beef with Russian dressing and coleslaw, and stood about 4 or 5 inches high that you can't even open your mouth to eat, you know, to take a bite. And the sandwiches came in and they were hungry because they went from the plane to a press conference at JFK Airport, and which was just sort of recently renamed that from Idlewild in December of 63. And so they went from JFK right to the Warwick Hotel, 20 minutes there into the press conference. And this was right after the press conference. So they were hungry. And everyone sat around. Everyone offered me a sandwich. And I said, oh, okay. I'd love a sandwich. So I ate some as well. And then an American DJ, Cousin Brucey, Cousin Bruce Morrow of WA, and the B stand, they started to call it Beatles C of WABC, took the Beatles into a different room off the main center suite. And he started to unload his broadcasting equipment. And I went in, I said goodbye to the Beatles. And I was led to the freight elevator by Sid Bernstein's assistant, and then the Beatles road manager. He was still road manager. Neil Aspinall brought me down with the freight elevator operator. And when we got to the ground floor, he opened up his blazer and he took out a copy of Spaniard in the Works, John's new book that I guess had recently just come out, and he handed it to me and he goes, this is for your collection. Aww. For your collection. And I left. And so the cover of my book is a photograph of me the day after I met the Beatles, and I'm sitting on my bed in my bedroom and I'm reading Spaniard in the Works, that book that Neil Aspinall handed me.
Oh, that's fabulous. What an amazing story. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Debbie Glender. If people want to get a copy of your book that we're talking about, it's called I Saw Them Standing There, Adventures of an Original Fan During Beatlemania and Beyond. And it's by Debbie Glender, who we've been chatting with today. Debbie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me onto your show, Hannah. I appreciate it.